this morning, Tuesday, February 6th. And we have back with us this morning, Dean Thorne. Delighted to have you here. Looking forward to finishing up the agency so we can get together with our sharp pens and go to work.
I think that's what they're worried about.
That's why they're always late and getting through their, you know, they force us into so many questions that we are, you know, just kind of have to slow down.
Okay,
that's good. Yeah. Okay. Good morning, Jean. How are you?
Fine. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Jean Thorne. I'm the Administrator of the Public Employees Benefit Board. And yesterday we were leaving off on page 373. And to just recap briefly, yesterday we talked about some of the accomplishments of PEB during this past biennium. And I think we've been very pleased that both on the programmatic front in terms of really looking for changes in the healthcare delivery system, we're on that path of implementing the board's strategic vision. And then on the operational side, we've made a number of changes this past biennium to really increase the efficiency of the processes within PEB and also within the state agency payroll and benefits staff. Page 373, then, we begin to outline how PEB supports the DAS strategic plan in the four areas of customer service, effective policies with clear direction, efficient and effective government infrastructure, and adaptable government for future generations. Specifically on customer service, we have, I think I noticed yesterday, we really see our customers as being two different groups, PEB members themselves. So we have about 120,000 covered lives. So we deal directly, our staff deal directly with members who may have questions about eligibility or benefits. And then also the agency and the university payroll and benefits officers are on the front line with employees as well. And so working with them to make sure they have the tools they need and the information they need. So we participate in the annual DAS survey, which is part of assessing from the agency or the university standpoint how we are doing. And then we also conduct an annual survey with our members. The last 2 years that has been online. And so we've been very pleased with the response. We just completed this past year's survey and are analyzing those results, but we had about 9,000 responses. And so that allows us to look at customer service issues and other issues that are of concern to the board. We have established turnaround times for PEB responses to member inquiries. We try to always get back now within one business day, at least to let the person know how we are responding to their issue. And we also try to, as much as we can, get information out to members so they don't have to necessarily call us or call their agencies. And that's in the form of newsletters, our website, frequently asked questions, emails. It is a challenge in terms of dealing with 120,000 members to get information out to them and to have it read. Sometimes I feel like we send and send and send and still people seem to be surprised, but we do what we can in terms of providing information out to people so they can have a better understanding of how to utilize services. Page 375, in terms of the effective policies with clear direction, we have this past year established an agency advisory committee, and that includes specific representatives from state agencies and universities who may be payroll or benefit staff. To provide feedback to us and input to us, and it's been very valuable. They have identified areas where they need more consistency in eligibility policy or where there may be questions so that we can clarify those, and the committee has been very helpful in helping us better look at what our priorities should be on the operational side. On the programmatic side, we have established what we call the Council of Innovators. We told those medical plans who were responding to our RFP that our expectation was those who were successful would participate with us and with each other in looking at best practices, at looking at how together we could advance the board's strategic vision. And so our four health plans have all committed their chief medical officer and an administrative management person to work together. We meet with them on a monthly basis to identify opportunities for intervention in terms of evidence-based care, what kinds of incentives for the market or for consumers could be helpful in looking at the benefit design. We also regularly look at claims data, evidence-based reviews, and I noted yesterday we undertook our first member health risk survey 2 years ago and plan on doing that every 2 years to really see what kinds of changes are we seeing in member health risk to help us identify programmatically where we may need to focus. On page 376, efficient and effective government infrastructure, the first two areas really are about, again, the operational side. How can we make, how can we have consistency in the application of eligibility policy? We use PEB.benefits to really be our tool and our agency advisory committee to work on that. The last category down here, again, is primarily on the programmatic side. What can we do to optimize the quality of the services themselves that are received through PEB benefits? And so I noted yesterday we have established and monitored and beginning to monitor now health plan performance measures. We are working with our health plans to determine focus areas for intervention. And so, for instance, we are asking our plans to respond in their renewal responses for 2008 on particular strategies, patient and provider-focused strategies around diabetes management, around low back pain and surgery. Oregon has the highest incidence of back surgeries in the United States in looking at Medicare data, and in some areas are much higher than that, and so we are working with together with our health plans to see what could be done to really look at more conservative treatments, but to make sure that those who do receive it in a timely manner. We also are working with the plans on evidence-based plan designs. Lastly, we will be evaluating our experience with self-insurance. We do have two smaller plans that we've been offering on a self-insured basis and now our dental plan this year, but really looking at potentially a broad expansion of self-insurance for 2009 and looking at both the risks and the benefits of that.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Crummell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Gene, we've been hearing a lot about evidence-based care and evidence-based plans and that sort of thing. It may be more complicated than trying to answer here, and if that's the case, you can just send it to us or submit it in writing. But what kind of evidence are you looking at? What's the literature that you're looking at? Around best practices. I guess the big question is who's providing the evidence and who's deciding what a best practice is?
Mr. Chair and Representative Crummell, let me give you two examples, one from the prescription drug area and then one in terms of other medical treatments. The Oregon Health Resources Commission, together with OHSU, Evidence-Based Practice Center, over the past several years, I think Dr. Smith spoke to it yesterday, has been doing evidence-based reviews around specific drug classes. And there's a systematic process in terms of looking at the studies and how the studies were conducted, what kind of bias there might be in the study, in order to look at, within a drug class, for instance, cholesterol-lowering drugs. Is there evidence to show that one drug is more effective than another? And frankly, in most of the cases, it's been shown there isn't a difference in effectiveness. And so the board utilized that, our board utilized that information last year in developing a new copay structure around prescription drugs. And so the board said in working with the health plans that they want to make sure that on their preferred drug lists were those drugs that have either been found to be more effective or were effective and were lower cost. And so we put in place a plan design that lowered the cost of generic drugs to $5, kept the preferred drugs at $15, but took on the non-preferred drugs from being $25 copay to the greater of $50 or 50% of costs. But at the same time, said to the plans, you need to put in place an exception process. So if a physician can show for an individual because maybe of other conditions they may have, this drug is necessary, that there would be an exception to that. And we've really seen, I mean, certainly there have been people with concerns being asked to change drugs, but we have seen a very positive response in that. So in that case, that's we are using the systematic reviews that the Health Resources Commission, together with OHSU, have undertaken. As we look, for instance, at low back pain, we have, together with our health plans, looked at data provided through Dartmouth. It's called the Dartmouth Atlas that really looks at what is occurring around the United States in terms of practice patterns. We've looked at the practice guidelines from a number of different national organizations and sat down with our health plans to look at what kinds of guidelines are appropriate. And there's some range in that in terms of what kind of waiting needs to occur, what kind of diagnostic imaging should occur at the front end, you know, what are the red flags that mean someone definitely should go into surgery. And so those are the kinds of looking at what does the evidence show us. We are working, I mentioned work we have undertaken directly with the OHSU Evidence-Based Practice Center. There's also a Center for Evidence-Based Policy there that we work with. So we look at and we rely on the experts who are experts in doing the evidence-based reviews to really help inform those processes.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Payne.
I don't want to make this a health care forum this morning, but we're about to get
on there.
But, Gene, may I ask a question?
Please.
Gene, first, I appreciate your answer to that question was excellent. And I would say
thank
that
you being a doctor, I'm glad that
it was excellent, absolutely excellent. And you know, the programs you have in place for control of drug costs are starting to pay off. And in many ways, it's the easiest part of the problem to deal with. The bigger problem is the one you alluded to, and back surgery is a good example of the problem. Okay. Whether a patient gets back surgery or not right now primarily is decided by that patient talking to a particular surgeon. And the incentives for getting that surgery are extremely high on a financial basis and extremely low on not doing it. So my question to you is, how are you getting that kind of information to the patient to say, do you really need the surgery? Are you really getting a true picture of what the outcomes of that surgery might be, both from the post-operative time and where you might be a year later? I mean, we know what the data really tells us. So how do you get that information to the patient, for me, is the key question, not just on this issue, but you can just go right down the line on a dozen different things. And the amount of money used in these situations is massive. It dwarfs the amount of money we're using in pharmaceuticals. Unnecessary surgeries, outcomes that are predicted to be bad and are bad, but done over and over and over again because there's a huge incentive to do the surgery and no incentive not to do the surgery. Now, that's just one example.
Mr. Chair and Senator Bates, we've had a very interesting discussion over the last several months with our Council of Innovators. And it's both what kind of information can we provide at the front end to, I would say, members generally about back surgery alternatives. Then how do we intervene once the member is a patient and with a primary care physician, and by the time they hit the surgeon, it's probably too late. They're ready for surgery. So we have, in talking with our plans, and we've asked them each to propose to us for 2009, because each plan is very different in terms of, three of our plans are integrated health systems, and then we have Regents, which is a open panel preferred provider organization. We've asked them how they would, and we've looked at decision support tools that are available and against evidence-based decision support tools that help members or patients look at various alternatives and, given their own values, what might be right for them. So we have asked them how they would use decision support tools, at what point, how they would get it to the patients, what kind of incentives. So, for instance, maybe they would say, if you've used a decision support tool and you do end up having the surgery, maybe there's no copay. I mean, those are just examples. So we've asked each of the plans to come back with us. We don't have their responses yet. How they would do that, how they would provide incentives within their health plan at the primary care provider level as well. So maybe to compensate those providers for doing additional counseling. and then how they would intervene at the surgical level. You have some plans that are integrated systems that require some level of prior authorization before surgeries. You have other plans that are wide open and don't, and it's really a philosophical issue for them. So we've looked at, and we understand it's not just dealing here or here or here. It really needs to be a multifaceted approach. So we're working with our health plans to figure out what can we do at the front end in PIB, what can they individually do with patients at various places along the continuum, and what can they do with providers, whether they're primary care or the surgeons, to really create those incentives.
Mr. Chair, what I'm hearing is they're just getting started. I appreciate you getting started on it, and I'd love to talk to you in private about it.
I'd love to do that.
Okay. Okay. It's a huge problem, and it's going to drive costs for state government and the general public right off the cliff.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Should we talk about diabetes now?
We could take program after program after program. We're not going to do that. I want to hear if they're making steps towards getting patients informed enough to start making some decisions that aren't just based on monetary rewards for physicians. And I hate to say it that way, and I'll probably have the OMA talking to me by 2 o'clock this afternoon. But 10:30. But that's what's happening. And when you look around our state and around the country, the different types of things are done for the same disease in different parts of the country are hugely different by factors of 10. And there's no logic to it. There's no logic to it. It's a cottage industry that has to change. So I'll get off my soapbox and thank you for your time. Please talk to me later.
I
thank you for indulging me, Mr.
Well,
Chair.
I appreciate the comments, and my discussion about diabetes would go on to the same.
Absolutely.
Same exact.
Absolutely.
Mr. Chair and Senator Bates, just one thing. I think it's been very interesting this past year as we pulled this group together with the health plans, with physicians who are their chief medical officers, who are very willing to talk about the incentives or the wrong incentives or the practice patterns. And they actually have said to us, this is the first time they've had a purchaser bring them together to a table to talk about these issues. They don't do it on their own. And so they have really have acknowledged a leadership role that we are playing in bringing the players to the table to talk about these issues. So moving on to 377, adaptable government for future generations, which actually leads into the first point. I think our board, in establishing its vision, said this is not something PEB can do on its own. We are the largest purchaser, but even there, if we are 10% of a patient load, that is not going to change the practice patterns. We really need other purchasers, others to be asking for the same kinds of things that PEB is asking for. So we are working and play leadership roles in both the Oregon Coalition of Healthcare Purchasers and the Oregon Healthcare Quality Corporation, where we're either working with other purchasers or with a broader set of stakeholders to really try to take the values and the initiatives of PEB and have others embrace those as well. And I would just say I've been very pleased with the responsiveness of those groups of really saying they recognize PEB leads the way and that they're looking at trying to do the same kinds of things.
Senator Thompson.
Thank you for making such a persuasive case for why the Oregon Educators Benefit Board ought to be part of PEB.
Thank you, Senator Johnson.
Representative Trump.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator, I couldn't agree with you more, if it's going to be formed at all. The question that I have is how are you defining others, Gene? Is it, are you talking like other employers that are in the private sector that are part of this organization, groups like Weyerhaeuser, Nike, and that sort of thing, or are you talking about other government employers, local governments, cities, counties, special districts, and that sort of thing?
Mr. Chair, Representative Crummell, the Coalition of Healthcare Purchasers is both public and private, and we're growing. I say we because I'm the vice chair. That's what happens when you don't show up for a meeting. But we have been working on really recruiting other private sector members and now have an alliance with the Oregon Business Council where they are encouraging their members. So PGE, Northwest Natural, Intel, a number of those other purchasers are joining. And we together are endorsing a national request for information called Evaluate, which really has many of the criteria that PEB has asked for, and we now have, I believe, 8 of the health plans in Oregon that will report on that. It's nationally scored, national metrics, so that all purchasers, we can be sending a consistent message about the kinds of things we're looking for in the healthcare system. So it is both public and private employers who are part of this. On the Healthcare Quality Corporation, which is a sister organization, and I'm on the steering committee for that, that includes purchasers, it includes provider groups, consultants, health plans. It really is a multi-stakeholder group that's looking at issues around quality. And we just received word last week. We've received a national Robert Wood Johnson grant to really, it's around aligning market forces for quality, and PEB, again, is playing a leadership role in that.
You guys got the $600,000.
Pardon me?
Yeah. We heard about a $600,000 grant. I was trying to find who it gone to.
Yes, the Oregon Healthcare Quality Corporation.
You guys have. Okay.
Thank you. For those of us that don't stew in the juices of medical delivery like you and Doc Bates do, it would be very helpful for our general education as legislators, I think, if you could give us kind of an organizational, not an organizational chart, but just a listing of all of the folks that are doing healthcare policy in Oregon. Or the most significant thing that you said was trying to align market forces for quality. Because what keeps haunting me is the idea that we've got these little pockets of either purchasing or policy. And I'm trying to figure out that if you turn the battleship by having the largest number of people in one place to actually cause markets to change, how scattered are we, and is that scattered a good thing or a bad thing? And I was teasing, I really wasn't, about OEBB earlier, but it seems to me that the more folks you can amalgamate in one place, the more the market pays attention. And if our goal is to make the market pay attention, and if our goal is to change practice habits, and if our goal is to turn the battleship, put as many people to that effort as possible. And I'm trying to get a sense of how many people are doing all of this. I know that Senator Westland and Senator Bates are taking on a Herculean task, and I'm just trying to figure out who all else is out there that has a dog in this fight.
Mr. Chair and Senator Johns, I'd be happy to pull some of that together for you. I would say what's really encouraging, the Oregon Healthcare Quality Corporation, which has a staff of one, really has become a place where people are coming together, and to actually apply for this grant required us to go out and bring everyone to the table. OHSU, the Northwest Health Foundation, the Office of Health Policy and Research is in the, we're the health division, privacy. I mean, there are a number of players coming together, and I think I wasn't at the committee last night, but I did see the presentation on transparency and quality from the Health Policy Commission. And the kinds of things, and we're part of that work group too, really speaks to, I think, some of the work and bringing that work together.
So I'd like to just have it amalgamated in one place. So for those of us that are cheering for change but don't do it every day and don't know who the players are or even speak the vocabulary, I would love to just have it in one place as a resource for my office.
I think, Mr. Chair and Senator Johnson, I'll work with the Office of Health Policy and Research, and we can pull something together, I think, that might help like that.
Mr. Chair, at the risk of this conversation either degenerating into a health care forum or elevating to a health care forum, depending on your point of view, I would offer that without this coming together in one group, it will never get there, and frankly, that's what health care reform is all about. And what's being offered is going to be one group to do this, the Oregon Health Trust Board, and that's probably the one that will end up doing this and really bring the state together, because it is right now Byzantine at best. And your efforts to bring it together are going to help, but you and I both know that's not going to get the job done. It's the first good step. But there are 20 groups in the state and hundreds across the nation trying to turn this ship around, and they're all over the place. And until we bring them together and focus them, we're never going to get there. And that's what the healthcare Reform Committee is going to try to pull off in this session. And I think we can do it. But I'm going to stop there, so
Senator,
we can move forward.
I was just going to ask Senator Bates a question as to how the subcommittee can help facilitate that for you.
I think if you can give us Gene Thorne for about a week, it would help. Okay, and I'm serious. I'm serious, Gene. You need to come to our committee and we need to talk about it, because the key to healthcare reform for us is going to be that health trust board that's going to bring this together and then start changing how we practice medicine in the state. And that's a huge change. Until we answer questions on why there's so much back surgery and why so much prostate surgery and why we have such bad outcomes in diabetes and hypertension and why everybody's doing things differently all over the state and best practices are not being followed across the state, until we change the incentives for how we practice medicine, we will never see improvement. We'll continue to be 30th in the world in outcomes and number one in spending. We've got to change it. And I'll get off my soapbox. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And Mr. Chair, I might suggest we have some policy option packages to help in terms of what the subcommittee might be able to do.
In light of all of the previous discussion we've had, and the fact that we're currently over your allotted time, I assume we've just spent your policy option package.
Mr. Chair, why don't I skip a few things here and get to some of the key things that I think would be important to understand, and then the policy option. So let's try for page 383. Which
has gone to 385.
Well, I think, first of all, perhaps, Mr. Chair, understanding the sources of our revenues so that that puts these in context. Unlike the rest of DAS, when we say fees and assessments, it's done a little differently. We have under statute our administrative costs are paid out of an administrative assessment that's included in the premiums. The board establishes that assessment. We could go up to 2% of premiums. We're currently at 0.6% of premiums. So the administrative costs for PEB, for PEB staff, are paid out of that assessment. It's set on a yearly basis. There are also some other accounts and reserves. The stabilization reserve is primarily funded through opt-out dollars, so employees who opt out a certain percentage of that, if they opt out because they have other group health insurance, comes in, so we receive interest on that. And then also there have been some one-time settlements around chronic disease management or mental health parity where the health plans may not quite know exactly how much they may cost or save, and so we've agreed on a formula, and if there are settlements that come in there. So that, as we move to the policy option packages, I just wanted to make sure you knew about those sources, because two of our packages are from one of those sources and one from another. Page 385, just to be clear, you'll see other funds non-limited. First of all, let me just note that the 0709 governor's recommended budget, the general funds there, is for the educators board, and that is not part of regular PEB because we work off of other funds. And then the large growth in non-limited is because of self-insurance, where the premiums are actually paid to us. We hold the money, we pay administrative fees to the plans, and then as claims come in, we pay against that. So this reflects we've had Providence and Samaritan as self-insured plans since last year, and ODS, the beginning this year, is self-insured. I'll skip over 386 because I think we've talked about some of those. 387 really is pretty much our strategic vision and then the kinds of things we've been talking about doing in terms of enhancing some of our systems around eligibility. So page 388 is our first policy package. This is to establish a position for PEB.benefits and also consulting costs for system upgrades. We brought up this system without any additional staff, and I think as we've moved into this and really, and as I noted yesterday, many of the efficiencies are really on the agency side because they no longer have to do the data entry. They no longer have to handle the number of forms, but it is a change process in terms of work process. So some assistance in helping on system upgrades, system adjustments, and also assisting design and implementation of training for agency staff. On the enhancements, just as in any system, you get into it, you make changes, and you continually see we could do more with this system. We have, through our agency advisory committee, received feedback in terms of the what they believe are the most important enhancements. So on the member module and on the agency module. And so $200,000 is included in this. Again, this is part of the administrative assessment, funded through the administrative assessment. And that links to the key performance measures around customer service. page 391 is a package that focuses, adds a position to provide staff support for quality and prevention initiatives. As I noted yesterday on our organization chart, we have one permanent position that is working on trying to move all of this stuff forward as we're working with our health plans and with our board. This position would assist in that those efforts, effective management of health plan performance, of really some of the monitoring and the research related, and also an emphasis on member wellness. I will say that after we concluded the last session, we received the results of the member survey that I mentioned yesterday, statistically valid survey of our members. And what we found was that, well, first of all, if you look at chronic diseases, which, you know, over time, chronic diseases take up more and more of healthcare expenditures, including PIBS. And the issues that are most related to chronic diseases include overweight and obesity, cholesterol levels, blood pressure levels, a lack of physical activity. When we looked at the results from the PEB enrollee survey, we were on the bad side of all of those compared with Oregon-employed adults. So the obesity level, for instance, was, even though it's not good for Oregon-employed adults, it was much higher, I believe about 30% of PEB enrollees. We had higher levels of blood pressure. Physical activity levels were less, nutrition issues. And much of that, frankly, can be explained when you control for age or gender or education, but it still means we have an issue. And those are issues we really need to address at the front end. And when we did this survey, we found that it's not only an issue of claims costs, but we asked those responding whether they had either missed work in the last 30 days because of issues of physical or emotional issues, or we asked them about their level of productivity. And 39% answered that in some way they had either missed work or had their productivity affected because of physical or emotional issues. That's not unusual. And I think employers more and more are understanding we've got to deal with some of these issues at the front end and help our members make easier choices, have them have the opportunity to engage in physical activity. So we need, our health plans are providing services, but we need to work. You can't just have them magically appear at work sites. We need that coordinating mechanism between our health plans, our state agencies. And I think Lindsay talked earlier in his presentation about the statewide, the Safety and Wellness Leadership Initiative.
Jean, how much does that cost? And practically, how's it going to work?
Mr. Chair and Senator Johnson, this is part of a position to coordinate with the health plans. So it's part of the cost of a position of work. The health plans provide services. They're doing the screenings. They're now doing worksite screenings, but we need to coordinate so they're there at the same time. We also found we just are getting the results of worksite screenings that were done. We had 2,700 of them done. On an exit survey, 70% said they received information that day that was new to them about their health, and that 40% of them felt they needed to then follow up with their physician. So but we need someone to coordinate between the health plans and with the agencies themselves and provide some technical assistance also to the agencies and how can they better promote. We also work with DHS Public Health. They do have a federal grant that has enabled them to have someone who can work with us, with counties, and with the private sector.
Senator Bates.
Jean, you've noted here effective management of health plan performance and what you're talking right now about emphasis on member wellness. Mm-hmm. I can't think of two more important things you can do to hold down health care costs and reverse this trend. So that's the key. How many people do you have right now working on those two initiatives?
We have one permanent position that we've had for a number of years working around program development. We currently do have a limited duration position we brought in this last summer to be assessed, and this would make that position permanent, and that's it. We have
the other
staff are all the operational staff dealing with member eligibility issues.
And eligibility and paying, mm-hmm. making sure claims get paid, right. and taking care of it. But this is the only thing you've got for this.
That's
right
really
now.
Programs.
But
yes.
You understand this is where you have to go.
Oh, yes. We definitely understand that.
Have you been able to persuade the director of the agency to use his agency as a test case?
Mr. Chair, we actually, Department of Administrative Services is one of the agencies that's participating in what we call the Healthy Work Sites Initiative, which we began the summer before last with a number of agencies really doing a more intensive role.
Can you give me some data as to whether or not you, what the effectiveness of that has been?
Mr. Chair, I think that the difficulty around wellness is trying to separate out what is going on in terms of health risks for employees and whether that's attributable to the wellness activities, whether it's attributable to them having, because at the same time we have health plans that have different kinds of issues. So we have more around the issue of metrics of statewide.
But if there's been some effectiveness, there should be, 2% reduction in absences,
hospitalization rates, days in hospital.
I would say, Mr. Chair, these are just beginning efforts, so they've only been starting the last few months.
But there are plenty of national
studies that show returns on investment.
But are we looking at that within these agencies and monitoring that carefully from the onset? I mean, that needs to be part of the
Mr. Chair, when we began the Healthy Work Sites Initiative, we asked those agencies that were participating to have their employees complete an online confidential survey around their health risks, and then the intent is we'll look at that on a yearly basis to see what kinds of changes we're seeing. And that's self-reported information, and the people reported last year may not be the same as this year, but we are seeing some positive movement across the agencies that have been involved in this.
Thank you.
The other part of 391, we would add $50,000 for physician consultant, which doesn't go very far over a two-year period, but as we work with physicians from the different health plans, we often find ourselves as lay people at a disadvantage. So this package would tie to the state workforce turnover. Again, if the healthier, more productive employees should lead to less turnover. Package 303 is out of our stabilization fund, and the stabilization fund can be used by the board to control expenditures, stabilize benefit premium rates, and self-insure. The board is, again, looking at, this would not be for any staff, this would be for external expertise, to assist in paying for that survey that I said we want to now conduct every 2 years, the employee survey, support for data gathering, reporting, and data analysis as we have these performance measures. We need to have some assistance in now gathering that together. It also includes a grant program to agencies, that small grant program that would assist them to support employee wellness with some things like instructional aids or exercise aids. At the most, we're looking at probably $15,000 for a larger agency, but really some money to help them do some of the things they'd like to do at their work sites. And then also support for additional research around evidence-based approaches to health coverage and to plan design, and support for development of health information infrastructure and exchanges. We've asked all our health plans to focus on electronic medical records, but what can we do to help bring those together? The Oregon Business Council has a major initiative around this, and purchasers are the ones who get the benefit out of electronic, in the end, of reduced duplication of services. So we want to support some of that. So really leveraging, utilizing some of the stabilization fund resources to leverage those other resources. We've been asked to hold on the Oregon Educators Benefit Board until that bill actually makes its, I believe it's on its way to Ways and Means now, so we would address that when that is heard by Ways and Means. The last slide, then, if we needed to take some reductions, we are proposing it's a less than full-time, lower-level fiscal analyst position. What that would require, we have one full-time fiscal coordinator. It would shift the workload from that analyst to the higher-level position, so potentially would have some impact on our ability to reconcile our records on a timely basis.
Thank you. And seeing no further questions, we will conclude this portion of the hearing this morning. Thank you very much, Jean, for your very informative, you went through and very rapid agenda idea. And at this point, we have Bill Foster with the Facilities Division. The speed with which your predecessor worked out on that gives you a tough act to follow. Good morning, Bill.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Bill Foster. I'm the administrator of the Facilities Division. And I would like to start out with a kind of an overview of the functions of the division and provide some context for the budget. DAS is one of 20 agencies that owns and manages facilities, owns approximately 3.2 million of the 14.3 of non-university facilities, and negotiates office lease for approximately 4 million square feet. The division has seven program areas: operations and maintenance, leasing, space planning and construction management, statewide facilities coordination, land sales and acquisitions, parking and administration. The division also wears two hats. We provide direct services to agencies as well as some statewide coordination regarding facilities and leasing. On page 399 is the organizational chart that lays out the different programs and shows the proposed option package. On the following pages are a brief summary of the program areas. Operations and maintenance provide services for 35 buildings and 9 that we do not own. There's three approaches to the way we bill for services: one, the uniform rent program, self-support program, and the service agreements. Leasing on the following page arranges private leases for state agencies. We lease approximately 4 million square feet and have a portfolio of about 600 leases. Parking and commuter services manages over 4,500 spaces and coordinates and facilitates commuter services to reduce traffic impacts. Interestingly enough, we also pay about $400,000 in property taxes because parking is seen as a private use. On page 403, the planning and construction management, the program manages design and construction of remodel and new construction projects, and new staff is being added to support the state hospital program. Page 404.
What portion, how much new staff is being added?
Chair Jensen, in our program option package, we had some positions that were added by eBoard that we currently have, and then we have some additional ones that will be added with this other package that's combined, and I believe the total is 8.
When we get to the policy option, you're going to explain more on that?
Yes, ma'am. Chair Jensen. Page 404, the statewide property management develops policies and standards, maintains a database for facilities, coordinates review with the Capital Projects Advisory Board, and buys and sells state property. Administration provides guides operations and policy for the division and assists state leaders in managing owned and leased property. On page 406, we have a listing of some of the major accomplishments for the 0507 biennium, and it includes developed an improved rent model that's more accurate and has allowed us to maintain the current rent level for uniform rent at $1.32.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Johnson.
I don't remember from sessions past, but your uniform rent at $1.32, you have some buildings that are anomalous, though, do you not, that go way above this?
Chair Jensen, Senator Johnson, yes. Uniform rent is the program where we have primarily office space, and it's pooled together, and the costs are averaged. Then we have what we call self-support, where you have a particular building, like a laboratory or something, that has higher rates.
How about the follow-ups? How about the veterans building?
Chair Jensen, Senator Johnson, the veterans building is owned by the Department of Veterans Affairs.
Three follow-ups. How does DAS provide leadership to other state agencies to make sure that their rents are appropriate, their buildings are? I mean, I see a lot of lurching towards Taj Mahal kind of buildings with rents that are prohibitive. What leadership do you provide other state agencies in looking at their building programs?
Chair Jensen, Senator Johnson, it varies. In the case of veterans, we have some review if it's being leased to another state agency. On the other hand, through the Capital Projects Advisory Board, we have a process of looking at various things that agencies are proposing and trying to see that what they're doing makes reasonable sense.
Mr. Chair, what I'm trying to get at is last session there was quite a bit of debate about empty space that was being paid for. With state agencies, and I'm trying to tease out from you, and I'm not doing very well. What degree of leadership does DAS provide to other agencies about cavernous space that's not occupied but bills are being paid on it? And what degree of oversight do you have as the head of the executive department in doing this kind of activity? Where do you have your thumb on agencies for bad behavior and lease practices?
Chair Jensen, Senator Johnson, we're working with the Secretary of State's office right now on an audit that is looking at that very issue. And while there have been some anomalies, one of which had a lot of scrutiny by the legislature in the last session, really it's unusual. And the report is not complete. It will not be out until April, but it appears that there's less than 3% of the leases that are really kind of outliers. And I think our other thought is we're working with them in terms of ways to perhaps put into the rules some means of asking agencies to give us information and maybe post it on the bulletin board so that space can be filled if others need it.
Last comment. Mm-hmm. Mr. Foster, if you ever stop working for DAS, there's a role for you in the diplomatic corps. Who are the outliers? How much space is out there that's unoccupied that rent's being paid on? How are you going to get your hand on it? Is that an appropriate thing for DAS to be doing? I think what the legislature and Oregonians are yearning for is some reassurance that somebody is sort of in charge, particularly when you're talking about capital construction here that may end up, if the legislature says okay, in building another building. And I'm just trying to get a sense of, is it the appropriate role for DAS to be watching the farm on this?
Well, Chair Jensen, members of the committee, my name is Lindsey Ball. I'm the director of the Department of Administrative Services. Let me try to help Bill out just a little bit here. You ask who's in charge, Senator Johnson. I am. Let me explain a couple things. This last year, in reviewing some of the things that came forth about space and space that was leased, one of the things that we've done in the Department of Administrative Services is that when we work up a lease agreement with a state agency, and this is typically, I think, where you'll find most of the latitude here is when we lease private space. an agency tells us they need X number, X amount of space. We go through the lease and contract services for that. We expect that they need all the space that they're asking for. We assume that they wouldn't want to spend any more money than they have to, etc. Now, maybe those were poor assumptions on our part, but I think that places a lot of confidence in agency directors for with respect to their performance in their respective agencies. We found that there were some shortcomings with that type of approach. We are auditing more closely than what we have before. As Mr. Foster explained, we are working with the Secretary of State's office in looking at space availability and costs associated with it and space that's being used. It's certainly not a perfect system. There have been some errors that have been made, and we're trying to correct those.
Thank you.
I can follow up on that, Senator Johnson. I do appreciate you know what you're saying, Lindsay, and appreciate that you've addressed this issue and probably will continue you know to address it vigorously. It ultimately it looks like if the issue doesn't get correctly resolved, the only really oversight that this issue has is going to be with the citizen legislature that is only around on a piecemeal basis, making it very difficult for a legislature or even a legislative committee that might be activated for such a purpose, to be very thorough in this. I understand the dilemma that I'm creating here. But I guess I see your assumptions that the other state agencies are reacting responsibly and therefore not looking at, an analysis of whether that space is actually needed, whether or not, somebody has to have the authority to say yes or no on some of these things. Maybe they don't have it, but at least it seems to me they should. So it puts us, I think, in a very difficult position. If NAS doesn't or someone doesn't do these things, when we have citizen complaints and issues come up and when there's large expenditures of state money that are very visible to perhaps the public out there. So, and I do appreciate what you're doing, and I appreciate the your accepting the responsibility for this. And I am looking forward to a much more efficient operation than perhaps we might have had at some other times. But I hope you can appreciate too. The difficulty that some of us in the legislature will have as we look at this problem.
Chair Jensen, members of the committee, I agree with you wholeheartedly. And I don't like to see money slipping out from underneath the door without appropriate use in response.
I know you don't. Greg.
Chair Jensen, members of the committee, picking up on page 406. We also received some delegated authority for procurement that allows us to be more efficient in delivering projects, streamlined project communication systems, completed the rework of web pages, streamlined our web information response time, completed the design of the and construction of the state data center on time and on budget to support that consolidation project, and implemented a new automated parking database. On page 407, facilities has developed various strategies for department goals, including customer service, clear policies, efficient and effective infrastructure, and adaptable government for the future.
Senator Whitson.
Thank you, Chair Jensen. Mr. Foster, going back to the major accomplishments, the first two there seem to have a a quantifiable amount of savings. I wonder if you could provide that to us. I'm sorry. For instance, there was no increase in per square foot rental for this projected biennium. How much money will that save compared to the, you know, on a linear line for what the rentals have cost in the past, and then on your reduced turnaround time, could you quantify the benefit of that?
Chair Jensen, Senator Whitsitt, I think the one is easily quantified, and we can do the others a little more difficult. We can make some assumptions if you would like us to do that, though.
Chair Jensen, Senator Whitsitt, maybe I can explain a little more detail for you. There, without having gone through and looked at the rent model and refined it more closely, we would have come in with a policy option package requesting a $1.36 rent for state agencies across the board. Now, you take the millions of square feet that comes under office rental, that comes to quite a chunk of change. I can't tell you what it is off the top of my head. But as we looked and deliberated over what it is our costs were associated with the rents that we were charging in the assessment, we came up with the calculation that we could hold the rent even from last biennium to this coming biennium. Now, with respect to the purchasing delegated authority for certain construction contracts, I can't speak to that specifically, and we can get back to you with more information on that. But as a level of comfort on the model that we the rent model that we used, that's the difference. And that's just an illustration of the things that we're trying to refine in the facilities division of the agency.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, what I'm getting at, I would like to see a little more specificity in accomplishments, particularly from the Department of Administrative Services, and that an accomplishment often is in either a measurable improvements in services or measurable savings in dollars. And some specificity would be appreciated.
Thank you, Senator. And I appreciate that, and I think that at least is part of the intention of these performance measures that we have, is to be able to find some quantifiable and have some quantifiable information. Yes.
On page 408 is some of our customer service issues in the strategic plan, and a major issue for facilities is timely and accurate information. The division has a number of strategies for improving the timeliness and accuracy of information. Moving to page 411, due to many interactions with agencies, clear policies are important. Rules and policies need to provide processes, standards, and accountability, streamline, be efficient and clear, and meet customer needs. Also, providing periodic training is important. Page 412, monitoring benchmarks for efficiency and cost effectiveness is another important element that we are taking seriously. 413, in optimizing performance, tension exists between documentation and accountability, and we, at the same time, we need efficient and streamlined processes and trying to keep that in balance. Page 414, attracting and maintaining a good, knowledgeable, and professional workforce is a growing problem for the future. We've looked at a variety of strategies, including promoting job rotations, creating career paths, and providing opportunities for staff to interact. 415, the physical and environmental support for information technology systems is an important role for facilities. With growing technology dependence, support is critical for the future of government. 416, a key initiative for the governor and the department is sustainability. Department and division play a key role in promoting and monitoring sustainable practices. And with the interagency task force, we've developed a methodology to track and reduce greenhouse gases. 417 facilities contributes to the agency-wide measures. Facilities key performance measures are customer service, the percent of good or excellent. Moving to page 420, a comparison between uniform rent rate as a percentage of the private market rate. Page 421, sustainability and the reduction of greenhouse gas emissions.
Excuse me, if I...
Yes.
What kind of time, personnel, and costs went into developing the metrics for tracking greenhouse gases and your efforts and energy there? And ballpark, I'm asking for...
Chair Jensen, it was a group of representatives from various state agencies that met over a period of maybe, 6 months, and
did we do audits, energy audits, on these buildings, and I'm referring to the Oregon State. Several years ago, a fairly sophisticated department that did a substantial amount of work here, and I'm wondering whether we were reinventing a wheel or whether they were even involved.
Chair Jensen, the university system was part of the group of agencies.
Okay. Thank you.
Page 422 shows the targets for the measures. 423 is a prioritized list of services, and priorities were based on impact to the largest number of customers, leveraging or controlling the largest amount of resources, and closest to the core mission of facilities division. 424, budget drivers for facilities are utility rates are uncertain. Maintenance, labor, and supply costs have increased. Completed projects have added additional debt service, and construction costs have been escalating. On page 425, 98% of the revenues for facilities division are fee for services, with the remaining two as assessments. On page 427, the breakdown of the budget is approximately 43% for debt service, 29% for personal services, 27% for services and supplies, and less than 1% for capital outlay. Page 428, for 07-09, the total increase of the budget is approximately 14% over 05-07. 5% of that is base budget adjustments. About 4% is inflation and service charge increases, and the last 5% is the policy packages, and discuss the policy packages a little later. Page 429, within the facility's budget is debt limitation for the Ochoco Youth Detention Facility that's a pass-through from military, and having DAS retain title allows military to leverage some future federal funds. Page 430, facility strives to for constant quality improvement in streamlining processes and efficient utilization of resources and assets. 431 is a future direction. Plan to continue improving our rent model, plan for the future build-out of the Capitol Mall, fully implementing the provisions of Senate Bill 90, which eliminated the Capital Planning Commission, and providing some support for the Oregon State Hospital replacement. Package 110 on page 432 is... really, this is kind of a housekeeping measure to get some limitation in the budget in recognition of the costs that are involved in positioning a property for sale. Page 433, packages 83 and 115, continue the e-board action and add additional positions for the Oregon State Hospital. There are two in package 83 that were previously approved by the emergency board, and this would put them into the budget. And moving to page 436, shows the additional five positions. So I misspoke previously. It's seven total, not eight. And the last package is on page 439. And this is providing funding for the first increment, 25% increment of purchasing renewable energy for DAS buildings. The efficiencies are listed on page 441. Producing 2% efficiencies from the 10% reduction list means eliminating one FTE from facilities that has been involved in tracking energy use and proposing solutions for building improvements. The consequence of this, our alternative is to use more expensive professional services contracts. The last segment of our operating budget is a capital improvement, starting on page 443.
Let's stop. I want to go back to the state hospital FTE. Why is it that we're needing seven new positions? Actually, not that many FTE, but seven new positions for them. We have had a state hospital that we've been running for more or less inefficiently and ineffectively for quite some time. But as far as your agency's role in this, why does improving this mean that we have to increase the number of staff that we have?
Chair Jensen, these positions are directly related to the construction project, and the reason
they're limited duration positions then?
Chair Jensen, the approach that was taken, and it's more from a pragmatic one, is to put them as permanent positions because this is over a period of time, and it really allows a better retention of staff. But the idea is really they are limited. They are for this project, and at the conclusion of the project, the positions would be eliminated.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the first two positions were approved by the emergency board as permanent positions. The rationale being this is going to be a long-term project, limited duration positions by their very nature. People come in and try and find a permanent position, not understanding that all positions in state government are really limited duration, biennium to biennium. Our analysts that have responsibility for the state hospital operation and this project are fully supportive of this because of the expertise that's needed to come to bear for the construction.
Okay, and specifically that's what I wanted you to want to get to with this, that it is the construction aspect of it, and that we do not have a long-term investments or alumni, investments, wrong word, but in the maintenance of these positions. Unfortunately, of course, as far as we in Ways and Means are concerned, the government of the state, and when these positions come in as permanent positions, every time we get a budget, there's a roll-up, and everything that's there is rolled up into it until there's some sort of microscopic check on it.
Well, Mr. Chair, with all due respect, I think there's a program roll down, too. When the hospital is built, you don't need the construction positions.
Why?
The funding will disappear, therefore the position should go away.
Senator Winston.
Thank you, Chair Jensen. Chair Jensen asked a question a minute ago that I didn't hear the answer to, and that was, has DAS performed or do they plan to perform energy audits on the state buildings to determine possible savings in energy under the Green Power Program?
Chair Jensen, Senator Whitsitt, they're related but unrelated. The POP is getting to renewable energy. We also have some other initiatives that we're engaging in that the governor has put on the table, and one of those is moving to 20% saving over baseline, and the intent is to get audits of all the buildings. And I believe that is some staff to support that effort is in the Department of Energy's budget.
Follow up.
And the answer is that the buildings have not been energy audited.
Chair Jensen, Senator Whitsitt, yes, just about everyone has. It's just that keeping energy on track is constant vigilance, and things happen and equipment changes, and so it needs to happen from time to time. And part of the function that we do with the Department of Energy is trying to monitor where that is.
Have the results of those energy audits been implemented? Have the buildings been improved to maintain their heat and cool structures?
Chair Jensen, Senator Whitsitt, the program that had been in place was a 10% savings, and that has been achieved by virtually all state agencies. The new ratchet up is going to 20. So it's going to take more effort. But agencies have been maintaining at that initial level.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank
you. On page 444, capital improvements by definition are under $500,000, and the limitation lasts for 2 years. They're part of the DAS operating budget, and unless funded by another agency or program, they will come out, the funds to support them will come out of the capital projects fund. New projects total $4.6 million, and we have a carryover of a little over $1 million. The major categories of these projects are grounds improvements at $260,000, parking improvements at $327,000, interior improvements at $404,000, emergency and tenant improvement projects are $800,000, building exterior improvements at $828,000, and component replacement at approximately $2
million. Mr. Chair.
Senator Johnson.
I'm confused. Where's that list, Mr. Foster?
Under capital improvements?
Yeah.
I just couldn't.
Chair Jensen, Senator Johnson, for purposes of talking about this, I summarized them, and the individual items are on those two pages, page 445 and 446, but I just made some totals of categories.
And, Mr. Chair, I guess the curiosity that I have is, give me a sample of what interior improvements would be or tenant improvement projects.
Chair Jensen, Senator Johnson, the tenant improvement projects is something that when we're working with agencies during the course of the biennium, we may need to modify some space to better utilize it, and that provides the funding to work with them. They're not pre-identified. It's an amount of funding that we have requested in our budget for many years and gives us some latitude to fit space up to accommodate new state tenants.
Did I understand you that you have 4.6 million in new projects and you've got a million carryover?
Chair Jensen, Senator Johnson, yes. And what happens with this, because it is just a two-year window, many times you have projects, and unless they can get designed early in the biennium, the weather or other events means that it's very difficult to get them completed by the end of the biennium, and consequently, that's why the request for the carryover.
One more. I'm not trying to quibble about this, but I'm just trying to figure out what's the rigor in the process for interior improvements. Agency X shows up and says, we want to move 28 cubicle walls and we need $100,000. You could just say, okay. Or does somebody scrutinize it for efficacy? Or
Chair Jensen, Senator Johnson, yes, it goes through a number of pieces of review. One of the things is a space request where we look at whether they're following the space standards that the department has. We look at what kinds of space and improvements are needed, whether there's walls, and determine that that is something that makes sense and meets those standards before we would proceed with it.
One last question. What's the difference between interior improvements and tenant improvements?
Chair Jensen, Senator Johnson, the interior improvements were some specific projects that were on our list, and they included improvements to restrooms in some of the buildings, conference rooms, some areas that needed attention in about four or five different buildings. The tenant improvements is really a undesignated fund to work with things that come along in the course of the biennium.
Thank you.
Do we have a list of the last biennium's projects?
Chair Jensen, we certainly can provide that.
Could you do that for me, please?
The last portion of our budget is the capital construction budget, and that starts on page 448. The department's capital budget includes projects that are $500,000 or greater, and the limitation for these projects lasts for 6 years. This will also be heard independently of the operating budget as House Bill 5006.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for those of you that are new to this, we, in the Ways and Means process, the various subcommittees will review individual agencies' capital construction requests. Agencies are supposed to have them reviewed by the Capital Projects Advisory Board also, but they will review these requests with the agency budget. The amount of the capital construction projects that you would recommend approval to, those projects are housed in a bill separate from the department's, various departments' operating budgets. Those budgets only extend for 2 years. The capital project has a six-year authority. All of the projects that are enumerated here are included in another, quote, capital projects bill, which will be in Ways and Means. It's generally heard towards the end of session, and what we provide then is recommendations out of the various subcommittees for various projects on there for the different departments, and then the subcommittee that is reviewing that bill basically looks at those items that haven't yet been reviewed in a subcommittee for one reason or another. So you will be asked, and part of the work session will be, to make a recommendation as to certain or on all of these capital projects. It just, they will not be part of the department's operating budget. They're in another budget bill, but you will be asked to make recommendations on them. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
There'll be another budget bill that will be heard by another sub. That may be heard by another sub.
May be heard by another sub, yes, sir.
Thank you.
Chair Jensen, members of the committee, the capital construction projects are included as a package 489 and include funding for the final phases of projects started in previous biennia, critical component replacements, renovation of key office buildings, planning for future biennia projects, and planning and building of the future mall building and parking structure. Planning projects total $1.3 million, building component replacements of $3.9 million. The renovation of the executive building is $4.5 million. Continuation of previous projects is $6.2 million. However, in that list is a project for the Justice Building that was in the budget. We got funding approved at the E-Board, so that will come out of that. So the 1.7 will go away, and then the new construction of 21.5. Walking through the individual projects, there's $670,000 for roof replacements. Mr. Chair, I'm not sure how much detail you would like on this or whether you would rather get to some of the broader discussion points on the major projects.
Well, why don't you go ahead as you had planned, and if we have questions, Senator, what's the
Mr. Foster, we're looking at the renovation of this building, and a quick mathematical equation shows it's about somewhere between $430 and $450 a square foot to remodel it, which seems awfully high. That's just an example. I'm wondering, how did this DAS go about determining the appropriateness of the contracts? I mean, are they competitively bid, or how do you compare them with private sector, taking into consideration the difference in prevailing wage and so forth? I mean, how does DAS work to maintain the lowest cost quality construction and repair?
Chair Jensen, Senator Whitsitt, we have different means of delivering projects that we've used over the years. The default, which is basically required in statute, is that it's competitively bid. But there are occasions when what's called CMGC, or Construction Manager General Contractor, or design build may be preferable alternatives. I think the point that you're getting to, though, is really more about what are the nature of the improvements, how it's designed, and that contains the costs, and perhaps a value engineering process or something of that nature. Certainly, with this building, you have some unique historical things that makes it a lot more expensive. But as to the renovation that we do, we try to keep it in a good cost-effective manner, and we're currently doing a Justice Building, and it has some of the same problems and attributes. On back to page 452, the Labor and Industries Building, $3.6 million for the last phase of a heating, ventilating, and air conditioning project and electrical improvements. $600,000 for the General Services Building space conversion that was previously started and is nearing completion. The $1.7 for the Justice Building, which we're going to remove. $600,000 for the red lot planning for a parking structure, and I think we probably need to talk about that in the context of mall expansion. And $500,000 for Central Mall Office Building number 3. $300,000 for security improvements phase 3. This was a case where the company that we had been using went out of business, and we were forced to put in a new system. Planning funds.
Senator Johnson.
I don't understand that. You were doing business with a vendor. They went out of business, and you got stuck holding a bag, or?
Chair Jensen, Senator Johnson, the issue is that this particular vendor was the folks that supplied the key card and that kind of security equipment, and once they went out of business, we can't get the parts. So what we're having to do is slowly convert to a new system so that parts are again available.
I guess I'm kind of mystified about contracts that don't have performance bonds when they're one-off vendors, or why it is that you end up having to transfer systems. I know that you can't anticipate when a vendor's going to go out of business, but it seems that on a state contract of this level of magnitude, having a company default, I'm just a little curious about how you end up with a contract with a vendor that disappears.
Chair Jensen, Senator Johnson, this is over a long period of time. We put in the system probably 15 years ago, so it's predicting the future, and certainly at the time that vendor was chosen, they seemed to be a very reputable company that had been in business for over 100 years. So it was a great surprise that they did in fact go under. Let's see. 1.5, backing up, $250,000 for planning funds for future biennial projects, $4.5 million for the...
What kind of projects? That's $250,000 for sort of planning projects. What are you planning for?
Chair Jensen, Senator Johnson, the work that goes on with those funds would be to estimate projects so that when we bring them to the legislature, we've got a reasonable handle on what the project is and what it's likely to cost. So, and to begin the process of looking at things so that we can make better informed decisions.
I'm sorry, I don't understand. Are you in this $250,000? Are you planning specific things?
Chair Jensen, Senator Johnson, it is a pool of money that we use when it's needed.
Could we call it a slush fund?
I wish I had one.
Yeah, I'm thinking exactly the same thing. I'd sure like to know in all of this policy option for capital construction, what's essential? What's really tied to stuff? I understand that you're going to be planning for a red lot parking lot. I understand that planning has to occur before you can build stuff. But I'm in a budget that we're being asked to comb for 2% savings off VBL. I'm a little curious what 250 buys other than just planning not otherwise specified.
Chair Jensen, Senator Johnson, I think that this is one of the foundational things of our putting a budget together, and it's what we need in terms of consultant services to give good estimates so that we can bring information here that makes sense. Without it, we really cannot provide a quality budget.
Mr. Chair, I'd be very curious to know how many consultant contracts facilities has open right now. If you could get that data to us.
Chair Jensen, Senator Johnson, yes, we'd be happy
and
to
what
do that.
What they're doing. And I still don't understand the 250. I just am flagging that for you. I'm going to be a tough sell on 250 not otherwise specified.
Chair Jensen, members of the committee, maybe I can help Mr. Foster out here a little bit. Planning is probably the most important key to any kind of a project. We had quite a discussion here earlier in the week about the scenic project and the state data center. that is what poor planning will do for you. Appropriate planning, budgeted here in this budget, will bring forth a plan as to how you can deliver on a project.
What so, projects, Lindsay?
Well, the projects that are before you here in this proposed budget, such as the building on the red lot, such as the renovation of the Justice Building, etc. That's the kind of planning that has to take place in front of it, so that when I come before you and I tell you we need X amount of dollars to perform this project for this purpose, then I can give you some assurance that the plan is in place and we've looked at the detail of the cost associated with the ultimate product. That's what planning will do for you.
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry to be so grumpy about this, and maybe it's just the display that I don't get. I would assume, back on page 251, for roof replacement, you're doing a certain degree of planning. You've got to know what roofs, what's the disruption to the flow of business, where are people going to go, how's it. But am I to deduce then that in the 670 for roof replacement phase two, there's no planning, and that all that planning money is over here in this 250?
I'd have to defer that to Bill Foster for his specific response to that question.
Chair Jensen, Senator Johnson, the 250 is really planning for the 09-11 budget. And what is in the other projects are the funds for actually producing. There are different levels of planning, and you know, some are what you're doing to specifically get to construction documents that can be bid. The other is to do a sufficient planning so that you can put it in your budget and have a good idea as to what is going to be done and what's going to be needed.
Just to make sure the horse is dead, Mr. Chair.
Mm-hmm.
Is this all consultant or is this internal?
Chair Jensen, Senator Johnson, it is generally external.
I'll be real eager to see that consultant list.
Chair Jensen, Senator Johnson, if I might, we have relied on outside contractors for most of the work and have not done it with staff, and that's been a long-term decision.
Okay. Mr. Chair? I'm not quibbling with that decision. I'm just curious who the open contracts are with, what they're for. If I were Queen, I'd have a list of the change orders, and I'll bet none of them are down. But I'm just, that's the kind of thing I'm curious. We're so focused right now on performance measures, and the piece that I'm struggling with is, I don't know where the performance measures are for the plethora of contractors that all the agencies use. ODOT contracts out most of its stuff. DHS contracts out a bunch of its stuff. Children and Families contracts out gazillions of dollars. And while we have you guys come before us for this, you know, every other year annual ritual of beating the hell out of agencies, I'm just not sure that I know where the downstream performance measures are. And I am somewhat loath to continue to say it's okay to do all this consultant work, but I don't know how the consultants are performing, and I don't know, other than asking you to provide me evidence that we're getting value for consultant contracts, I don't know how this money's being spent. I don't know how many kids are being saved in Children and Families, which isn't your problem. I don't know how many teen pregnancies are being reduced, again, not your problem. I don't know what we're buying for $250,000 in consultant services. I'd love to know their administrative overhead. Some of these consultants, in my experience, are packing 20% administrative overhead. But what are the deliverables? What are you going to buy for $250,000? And I know planning is good, and thank God Lindsay came in and replanned Scenic, or we'd be sitting here arguing over $100 million that had augured into the ground. But I just want to know what we're buying.
Chair Jensen, Senator Johnson, we'll get the list for you.
Cool.
I think in light of the fact the Chair's got solid booking for the rest of the morning, we will wrap up, and if we need, we'll be back.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I believe it would be helpful to go over the plan for the Capitol Mall in more detail. So bring them back. I would recommend bringing them back tomorrow morning to talk about this red lot, the Capital Mall office building, so you can see kind of the future, because part of it is the 07-09 biennium, and part of it is 09-11 and the like. And I think it wants a further discussion.
And just so Mr. Foster doesn't feel ambushed tomorrow, the things I'm curious about are, to what degree is that new planned office building, who's the tenant base? And if it is folks that are coming out of this building, for example, the three constitutional officers out of this building, to what degree are they involved in the planning? What's the harmonic, or the harmonization, how are you harmonized with Dave Henderson's plan here? What other tenants are planned for that $40 million building? Those sorts of questions.
Okay. We'll see you tomorrow morning.